Oh, yeah, there we go. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Susan and Michelle, for the invite to be with you wonderful folks today. It's been a long time since I've been in this little building. You know, all the people that was here before, they either passed on or they retired. You know, I used to work closely with the people out of this church and other churches in regards to First Nations people. And it's always kind of an honor to sit with people and be with people when people are trying to make a change, not only for us, but for themselves. Or whether it be like Susan was talking about, climate change. You know, when we make these changes for ourselves, it's not for us in particular, it's for our little ones that sit before us. We have to put our pride aside and think about our children. And when we do things for our children, we not only are doing things for our children and those not yet born, those that are newly born, we do it for the rest of mankind. But when we do things and we try to make a change for the future, we should be doing it with compassion and love, not because we have to. I see a lot of people doing things out there for climate change, for First Nations people, or for third world countries, but they do it because they have to do it, not because they do it from the heart or with compassion. I always tell people, if you want to do something for mankind, you want to do something for the land that we walk on, the land that we share in our homes, do it with the compassion and love that we have, as we have for our children. Because if we don't look after what we have, we tend to lose it. People wonder why the climate change is happening, the things are happening, First Nations, third world countries. Simple reason is the fact that we don't look after our children. And again, as I said earlier, a little while ago, we do things because we have to, because it makes us look good. And we don't really face the challenges in life that are before us or the changes that we have to face every day. But anyway, I just wanted to say I'm honored, I'm happy to be here, be sitting with you wonderful folks and the wonderful children.
Thank you so much, Mr. Smith. As we enter this sacred time, kindly ensure that you have turned any cell phones to a quiet mode. Let us prepare for worship in a spirit of intention. As part of the reconciliation and relationship dialogues which were offered this past spring, each of these four sessions began with a music video to help focus our thoughts. For the final session, dialogue co-facilitator Chelsea Horton, who will light our chalice today, chose the music video, Beneficiary, by Settler Halifax rock indie band Wintersleep, a song written in response to a remark by the Booker Prize-winning Australian author, Peter Carey, explaining why he chose to write about the impact of colonialism as a white settler. In an interview by The Guardian about his 2018 novel, A Long Way Home, Carey said, "It's no good not engaging with something that you've been intrinsically involved in. You wake up in the morning and you are the beneficiary of a genocide." I'm an Australian writer, and I haven't written about this. Well, that just seems pathetic to me, unquote. Beneficiary will be performed for us this morning by Fritz Schultz and Jen Rashley. I would like to invite anyone who participated in any of last spring's reconciliation and relationship dialogues, either at UVic, hosted here at church, or in Michelle's home, and those of us who have participated in other UU contributions to the process of reconciliation with Indigenous peoples, to please come up front now and gather on the risers while I introduce our chalice lighters. I would now like to introduce Connie Braun, who will read a poem for our meditation today. Connie has authored two books about displacement and the immigrant refugee experience. Her first book, The Steppes Are the Color of Sepia, which is about her father's experience in the Ukraine, where he was born in 1931. Her other book, Salentium and Other Reflections on Memory, Sorrow, Place, and the Sacred, speaks of her mother's life in Poland, where she was born in 1939. Connie herself was born and raised in the Fraser Valley on the traditional territory of the Matsqui First Nation and the Sumas First Nation, both part of the Stolo Nation. Her heritage and faith tradition is Mennonite. Connie wrote this poem in response to Michelle Brown's poem after attending a Planet Earth poetry workshop on writing the poetry of trauma. And then Michelle will share her poem during her sermon. Connie.
Just one note that you may need to know for clarification. The Sumas Lake that I will refer to in the poem is the Abbotsford area where I grew up. It was drained in the 1920s. And the Vistula is the area in Poland that was drained for farming and where the Mennonites settled. This poem is called Local History, After Beneficiary of a Genocide by Michelle Brown. Afterwards, you were born on the dry bed, a lake once home, to migrating birds in a valley, a prairie, lush with your future. You are the beneficiary, she had said, a tall willow with long silver hair, and you cried by a mountain lake in April. Long before the crops were planted, the Tsimshian fished for the sturgeon, before they lay gasping in the mud, before the birds disappeared and the surrounding wetlands grew into your city. Privilege carries the whole condition of the human heart. Your ancestors drained the Vistula's lowland for farming, settled the Pontic steppes at the invitation of the Tsarina because she knew of their skill with the land. They settled here with their stories, 16th century Anabaptist martyrs, Holodomor, Gulag, Holocaust, war. Refugee and immigrant arrived in this valley with plowshares and pruning hooks, raised children, you who knew the Bible, thinking that the word genocide and exile belonged to history elsewhere.
Now I'd like to invite Cadence Moffat McCann to come forward for her personal reflection. Cadence was a dialogue participant who works at the Wasanuck Leadership Secondary School. Welcome, Cadence.
Hello, Kimita Hashiv, East Misha Cadence. So I just introduced myself in one of my ancestral languages, which is Scots Gaelic. My ancestors are mostly Celtic and some Slavic, and I also have a little bit of Kaniaki Haka, which is also known as Mohawk. I want to say thank you to Michelle for inviting me to speak today, for the immense emotional labor that she has invested in this work. It's phenomenal. I would also like to express gratitude to the Wasanich peoples for allowing us to be here in this sacred land today. It's not something that I take lightly, and I feel very blessed and very honored to live in this place that I call home. I actually grew up just down the road, so this place is very familiar to me, and I have a very strong connection to this land. I'd like to speak today about the two-row wampum belt. So this comes from the Haudenosaunee Confederacy in what is now known as Ontario. And this is how the Haudenosaunee Confederacy recorded the treaties between themselves and Europeans. My understanding of the two-row wampum belt is that it shows two parallel and separate paths. And I think that this is a really important and valuable teaching for us at this time, in particular as settlers, as we try to navigate the time of reconciliation and decolonization of these lands. This has been a really important teaching for myself personally, because it has really called me to look at my own family history and my own ancestry, to look at the history of Europe, 2,000 years of oppression and patriarchy and trauma and wounding that was embedded into the bodies of my ancestors that they fled from when they came here and they brought with them and inflicted upon the peoples and the lands of this place, that we continue to carry in our bodies. There is an immense amount of wounding and trauma in settler bodies, and I think it's really important for us to start to do the healing work of grieving that trauma and that wounding, of healing, and through that process, retrieving our own ancestral cultures. I spent 20 years traveling the world, learning about other Indigenous cultures, and that was an honor, and that was a blessing, and that was amazing. But it's only been over the last year that I've really started looking at my own ancestry. And it's opened up a whole other world for me in terms of understanding what it is to be a European descendant. The beauty and the medicine and the healing of those cultures is in my blood. It's in my body. We all carry that with us. And it's a totally different experience than learning about someone else's culture. And as a result, often appropriating that culture as our own. So as Susan mentioned, I work at the tribal school down the road. And I have the immense honor of working with the grade 6 students that are the first cohort that have been immersed in their Senchothen language since they were in kindergarten. These students are so proud of their identity. It's amazing. They are fighting against the genocide. They are reclaiming their culture. They are reclaiming pride in who they are as Indigenous Wasanich peoples. It blows my mind. And I see that the deeper I connect with my own culture, the more I am able to show up in support of them and their journeys. They inspire me to learn more of my language, to learn more about my culture. It's in a beautiful sharing opportunity that we have to be able to continue down these paths together. So I really feel that this wampum belt is demonstrating the urgent need for us to walk alongside First Nations of Turtle Island on our own healing journeys so that we can continue to support a process of decolonization and healing from hundreds of years of genocide of these lands. So I would like to close by saying the only two other words that I now know in Scots Gaelic, which are thank you, tapalive.
Thank you so much, Cadence. It is again my pleasure to welcome Michelle Poirier-Brown back to First Unitarian. She has been a guest speaker here on several occasions. Michelle is a Cree Métis poet, performer, and homilist. She is a member of the Advisory Council at the Center for Studies in Religion and Society at the University of Victoria, and a retired treaty negotiator. Please welcome Michelle.
Thank you, Susan. I want to start by thanking our neighbor, Kwasikalak, Fraser Smith, for starting us this morning in a good way. Thank you for being so generous with your time. Thank you for being generous with your wisdom. Kwasikalak, thank you for helping me, for removing the artificial separation between us, showing me how I can live here in a good way. Kina nas komitan. Tanse. Hello. It's nice to be here in a Unitarian Universalist pulpit today. I want to thank you for the warm welcome you have extended to the many friends of mine who have come here today, and an especially warm welcome to those of you who don't know me, have never been here before, but who just wanted to show up. Showing up is a very positive thing to do. I have promised a reflection on my experience co-facilitating a year-long sustained dialogue on reconciliation and relationship at UVic, as well as two small series sponsored here by this church, First Unitarian. Before I talk about what the experience was like, I want to be clear about how it started. This was not a feel-good, let's all be progressive and do this dialogue thing style of undertaking. The seed for this dialogue was planted during one of the daily coffee talk gatherings at UVic's Center for Study in Religion and Society. The center takes an uncommon approach to the practice of scholarship. All fellows in residence are expected to participate in a daily circle of conversation. It is an opportunity for scholars from around the world to come together in a library that seats about 15 people and speak on any given topic from a range of social perspectives, and to do so every day. I was a community fellow at the center in the late summer of 2017, decompressing after 3 months fieldwork studying Unitarianism and the Sakay Nation in Transylvania. I would join coffee talk once or twice a week. I was in fellowship with scholars with interests as diverse as how millennials are making meaning after leaving the church and Islam and politics in Arab Spring countries. On this particular day, the topic for discussion was the unveiling of UVic's new territorial acknowledgement statement. we were going to be talking about something that was central to my personal values and practice, and I was once again the only Indigenous person in the room. The summary version of that coffee talk is that I was profoundly uncomfortable with the words I heard said in the room that day. And Paul Bramadat, the director of the center and a man whose work many of you know, paused the conversation and asked me to speak. When I was finished, he asked me to come back after my fellowship and say more. Over time, Paul and I worked out the conditions. I would not have to be alone. Dr. Chelsea Horton, a settler Canadian historian who researches and teaches in Indigenous history, agreed to co-facilitate. Chelsea made a commitment to facilitate a coffee talk with me every second Thursday. We would talk about whatever came up, and the dialogue would... Oh, there's water. Super. We would talk about whatever came up, and the dialogue would continue for as long as I felt it needed to. And so the dialogue began. We met every 2 weeks for 1 hour. The conversations got easier over time. Participants began to experience the line between us shifting, eventually filtering through us and encircling us. But then the fellowship cohort would change, and we'd be confronted with something new, a new separateness, a new perspective unique to each participant. Always, absence of understanding was at the heart of the challenge. We talked to understand. Early in the series, after the fourth session, I answered a call for essays on speaking truth in a post-truth era. The anthology, called Dissent, was edited by George Eliot Clark and Sunita Fazich. In my essay, called Dialogue, A Seditious Act, I wrote the following. We feel a kinship with Camp Mokinstis, the awareness site set up across the street from Calgary's downtown courthouse in response to the verdicts in the Colton Bushee and Tina Fontaine murder trials. In that instance, Garrett C. Smith, a Blackfoot man from Treaty 7 territory, set up a tent and vowed to stay until he felt an understanding had been achieved between settler and Indigenous cultures. 2 months later, he is still there, his tent joined now by two Blackfoot-style teepees, and the site has become an awareness center for Blackfoot culture. Indigenous existence no longer invisible. Smith was plain-spoken in his invitation to settler Canadians to visit the tent. I want non-natives to come by and engage in conversation with me. This is a safe place to ask the ignorant, stupid, racist questions we all have. Unquote. That's what Chelsea and I set out to create, a safe place to ask the ignorant, stupid, racist questions that we all have. After some months of doing this, a congregant from First Unitarian made a proposal that the church sponsor similar conversations here. First Unitarian sponsored two groups, with the result that for the last four sessions of the now year-long dialogue at UVic, Chelsea and I facilitated a dialogue at UVic in the morning, here on church property in the afternoon, and at my home in the evening. I want to take just a moment to praise both the university and this church for these simple acts that have contributed positively to Indigenous relations in this area of the country where our neighbors, who have lived here millennia, speak Tsleil-Waututh. And just south of here, where many of us have houses, speak Lekwungen. When settler people talk to Indigenous people about Indigenous relations in Canada, they often ask, what can we do? Lee Maracle, one of the writers I most admire, answers this question in her book, Conversations with Canadians. She says, show up. In this case, you were invited to a conversation, and you showed up. And after you found out the conversation was not going to be about reconciliation and Indigenous relations, but was going to be a reconciliation and an exposure of relationship in real time, you came back. This kind of activity is exemplary. It sets a good example. I want you to notice it's not particularly extraordinary behavior. It is not heroic, but it is focused. And all focused behavior is a form of meditation. It is the ordinary, the quotidian, done with attentiveness and care. Like conversation with your neighbor, a conversation to which you bring honesty and meet each other with kindness. That is simple, exemplary work, and I commend you for it. It was hard work for all of us. When I was writing this homily, I got stuck at this point. I would write, I would delete, write more, delete. I needed to get to the point where I was writing just about my feelings, what it was like for me. And it was very hard to put aside my urge to acknowledge that it was hard for everyone, that there were times when I would know someone was leaving the circle having had their ideas challenged, possibly feeling their words had not been understood, their intent unacknowledged, possibly even feeling it was more than their ideas that were challenged, that in some way their sense of themselves, of who they were, and their place in Canadian society had been challenged, even attacked. I would get stuck wondering how I could honor the struggle that everyone brought to the room and still say what I felt needed to be said if I was going to answer the question of what these dialogues were like for me honestly. Honesty in writing is always an elusive goal. As poets, we often have material in us we want to bring to the page, but it stays locked inside of us. So we go to writing retreats. Through a combination of warm-up exercises and the pressure of a strict requirement to produce a poem by 9 a.m. or don't bother coming to class, we can sometimes break through the silence and speak something onto the page that has been sitting on our heart like a stone. I was at such a retreat in April of this year. It was the retreat where Connie and I met and where she heard the poem I'm about to read. I wrote this in response to an assignment called Staring into the Rocks, an assignment designed to have us articulate something that, left to ourselves, we would find unspeakable. I found myself confronting residual feelings from things I had heard in the course of the dialogues, and, in particular, the feelings I had about resistance folks had shown to identifying with the term settler as a way of referring to oneself or anyone else who does not identify as a person Indigenous to Turtle Island. The outcome was a poem titled Beneficiaries of a Genocide, much as it puts my heart in my throat to do so. I'm going to read it to you now. This poem has a headnote which reads, after listening to Beneficiary by Wintersleep and reading Peter Carey interviewed in The Guardian, November 18th, 2017. (Clears throat) beneficiaries of a genocide? You, who cannot call yourself settler. That's what I want you to call yourselves. You who speak to me, who speak about me in the third person, even though I've introduced myself and am sitting right here. Who say stupid things without knowing it. Like, but don't you sometimes wish you had a status card? And I don't see why they don't do better by themselves. After all, they get a free education. I don't care if you only came here 60 years ago or how bad your ancestors had it in the place you came from, or you think the real problem is capitalism or any other reason you don't identify with colonialism. You're still settlers, all of you. If your family came into the country under the authority of an asserted power calling itself the Government of Canada, you are, in the terminology of that self-same entity still in use today, a settler. It pains me to explain your government to you. I don't imagine you'll like this term any better, beneficiary of a genocide. But I think it narrows the argument. How much longer do we have to hear about your very real pain before you will have a conversation with us about ours? How much longer will you ask that your immediate needs take precedence over the fundamentals of our existence? What does it mean, this Aboriginal title? Does it mean they own the land? Are they going to come and take it back? Yes, and as a matter of fact. But put that aside. I will leave the future to explain itself to you. For now, let us stay in the present. Let us stay in this room where you are now uncomfortable and I am now unwelcome. Let us begin with what you call yourselves. It helps to breathe. Beneficiaries of a Genocide is an honest poem. It's important to me to be honest with you. What were these dialogues like for me? It was frequently an exercise in anger management. In that way, my experience was probably not so different from that of others in the room. I, too, went home from the dialogues tired. But it was not just taxing. It was also nourishing. Yes, there was the time a participant made a joke about Indigenous culture that I was not able to find funny. I was never given the opportunity to unpack that. But I was given the opportunity to draw a link between a medicine wheel teaching and a Christian practice that broke through a separation between myself and a participant who was a lifelong Anglican and enabled us to experience friendship. I think you can imagine how that would feel. You might also appreciate how satisfying it was for me when, after four sessions at UVic talking about the Trans Mountain Pipeline, I watched faces transform as a few participants were able to put together the implications of the Supreme Court's declaration of Aboriginal title for the Silcote Nation with the stance of the Tsleil-Waututh with regards to the pipeline terminal in Burnaby. I'd like you to try to imagine the importance of that moment for me, what it might be like to see the Indigenous perspective on an issue of national importance filter through concerns about climate change and species extinction and take an accurate place in the conversation. I'd like you to imagine, too, what it was like for me to be offered tobacco, to have it placed on a table nearby, for me to have the option to pick it up, to be respected in this way, and to have been brought small gifts and things to eat, to have been treated with such ordinary thoughtfulness. So what was it like? It was complicated. And there is so much more to unpack. This whole business, as my poem ends, of beginning with what we call ourselves. Someday, I hope to have the opportunity to talk about that. I experience so much cognitive dissonance between the way people introduce themselves to me and the way settler Canadians introduce themselves to me when they think they're doing the same thing. I have so much to say about that. But now is not the time. Now is the time to take a moment and notice how we all have changed. I've been changed. I'm braver now and calmer. I've had many deep experiences this past year, all of which have contributed to this clearer, calmer, more determined sense of myself. But certainly the experience of co-facilitating these dialogues has to number among the most significant. I know that participants, too, have experienced shifts. Several have spoken to me about how they feel they themselves are different now, feel more ready for relationship, feel they have a sense of what they want to do next on the journey. So that is what we will talk about next at the next opportunity, which, as luck would have it, will be today. Our host congregation today has invited those who are interested to join me and some of the folks who participated in the dialogues for an hour of facilitated conversation. Susan's given instructions on how much time you will have for coffee before we gather in the farmhouse. It will be a chance for other people to talk about what the experience has been like for them and the kind of change they feel called to make next. I will be showing up for this. Any of you who feel interested, you're welcome to show up too. Écosse.
That was one of the videos that we watched to start off our dialogues. There are several other videos.